Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
How much value does Pepsi get from its relationship with the Dallas Cowboys? How do the Philadelphia 76ers generate $250,000 in annual new revenue given its on-the-court struggles? How much should the Major League Baseball teams pay their players based on their on-field, off-field performance? These aren't hypotheticals, but answers that Block 6 Analytics is answering for leading companies in the sports industry. Adam Grossman is the CEO and founder of the sports sponsorship technology and analytics firm Block 6 Analytics, whose clients include Pepsi, Gatorade, Dallas Cowboys, Cleveland Browns, Philadelphia 76ers, and Comcast Sportsnet, among others. In addition, he's a lecturer for Northwestern University's Masters of Sports Administration, where he has developed two classes and teaches them. Their classes focused on developing and communicating strategic insights through data. Adam is also the co-author of The Sports Strategist, Developing Leaders for a High-Performance Industry, the featured book at the 2015 Sloan Sports Analytics Conference. He's written for Forbes, The Washington Post, The Chicago Tribune, and Comcast Sportsnet Chicago. And he's been featured as an industry expert on CNN, Marketplace, SB Nation Radio, and The Post Game. Adam is a longtime friend of mine and MBA Missions. I'm actually, full disclosure, a small seed investor in B6A, Block 6 Analytics seed round. I think that bodes well for the show, as I have a real comfort with him, and I can really hammer him with some questions. That's meant tongue-in-cheek, of course. I'm your host, Jeremy Scheinwald here. I think those who know the podcast know that I've been a longtime volunteer, mentor, and avid podcaster for Venture for America. We've done about close to 90 episodes now. You can go back into our catalog and cherry-pick them if you'd like. Hopefully, we've engaged many entrepreneurs in our podcast and in VFA. What is VFA? Well, Venture for America, after 5 weeks of training, VFA fellows spend 2 years in the trenches of a startup in an emerging U.S. city where they learn how to contribute to a high-growth business. Afterwards, VFA provides the mentorship, network, and resources fellows need to become entrepreneurs. To learn more about Venture for America or to support our work, or even to make a donation, you can visit ventureforamerica.org. It's a remarkable fellowship for recent college grads and new college grads, recent college grads. I wish it had been around when I was graduating. If you know a young entrepreneur, I highly recommend going to the site and directing that entrepreneur to the site, telling them about this amazing opportunity. As I noted, I hope you're a loyal listener to the podcast. Please take a moment to like our show on iTunes. It helps us get other listeners. You can follow me on Twitter at Jeremy Scheinwald. I'm not that active a tweeter, but hey, why not follow me? You can LinkedIn me. I accept all requests and try to help people out when I can. So anyway, we love listeners. Please tell someone about our show. I've had way too much caffeine today. I think this is a pretty energetic opening. I think let's get to the show. Let's get to our episode with my good friend, Adam Grossman of Block 6 Analytics.
Welcome to Smart People Should Build Things, the Venture for America podcast.
Building things can be really hard, and entrepreneurship is often portrayed in the media as the sexy or even worse, easy career path. Through this series, we plan to pull back the curtain and tell the gritty stories of entrepreneurship. We're striving to create a relaxed environment where entrepreneurs feel free to tell their stories.
This is Smart People Should Build Things, the Venture for America podcast.
No, you are looking good. I mean, you lost some weight. You got the beard going.
The beard's been going for a while. I know you haven't seen it, but it's been going for a while.
No, I have seen the beard.
It's
now it's kempt.
Yeah, it's as kempt, I think, as you've seen it.
Yeah, so I don't know what kind of intro they're going to keep, but I'm talking with my good friend, Adam Grossman. Known each other for a long time now, I guess, about
seven years.
Known you for a long time.
It's a long time.
Oh boy, we'll skip on that. So okay, let's talk about you, your entrepreneurial journey. Let's talk about Block 6 Analytics. Let's talk about a lot, but you're in the sports analytics business, and you yourself were once an athlete. I feel like I should put that in quotes.
Because
I'm saying once an athlete, and then I'm also kind of also trying to pick on you a little bit by saying athlete with quotes.
Well, I think we could start this, and if we're going to start it out, we should start it the way that this podcast is going to go with my Jewish Sports Hall of Fame story. So
Okay, and
hopefully, I'm 100% sure that the only thing...
I'm pretty sure I'm in that Hall of Fame as well, if that's where you're going.
Well, yeah. You'll see. I am not in the Hall of Fame. That's the point of the story.
Okay.
So, and I was going to say, this is probably how the rest of the podcast is going to go, so I guess the listeners should get used to it. So I played goalie for Northwestern when I was in college. Before I had played a single minute, I got an invitation to a Jewish Sports Hall of Fame. And I guess it goes to show you what level of athletic success you have to get and obtain to be in the Jewish Sports Hall of Fame.
Right.
Having played 0 minutes in college
was
qualified me because I was on a college team or a Big Ten team. So I, as a college student, there was a cost associated with being in the Hall of Fame. I think it was like $50. And I said, that's too expensive. I do not want to pay the $50 to be in the Jewish Sports Hall of Fame. So that immediately should have qualified me because I didn't want to pay for it. That's immediately should have put me in the Jewish Sports Hall of Fame. So I still am contending to this day I should be in that Jewish Sports Hall of Fame because of my decision-making process.
So you are starting our show by invoking stereotypes.
No question.
People. Okay.
That's how we got to where we are.
I have a gripe with the Manitoba Jewish Sports Hall of Fame, which is they will only accept individuals as opposed to teams. So I went to Hebrew school in grade 12, and 12th grade, as we say in the United States, and we won the provincial championship, and they will not admit our team into the Hall of Fame. I don't think anyone else is really concerned about this, though, or even we're not even a footnote.
I thought Justin Trudeau, this is his number one priority.
This is his number one. Okay. I want to ask you a question quickly about your goaltending, which is, statistically speaking, were you a good goalie?
It depends what you mean by good goalie. If you mean that did I get scored on a lot by the opposing team while I was in college, yes. So I was not a good goalie in that sense. In terms
the quality
of
those shots, though.
But I will say, when I was playing, we were playing Indiana, which was one of the best teams in the country at the time. And the game before we played them, one of their players was in Sports Illustrated, and he came in on a breakaway and was like, this guy was just in Sports Illustrated. There's no chance I am blocking his shot. And he did actually score very quickly after I had that bullet. So I would say I was a good enough goalie to make it a Division I team that the entire time I was on the team, we won one game. So I don't know what that... Statistically speaking, I played for 2 years. We were like 132-3
right.
in my 2 years on the team. So essentially you... Lost, or you only won one less game than I did in college soccer. So,
I have so many questions. Actually, do you want to continue asking about college soccer? But I think we should talk about the business. You're at Northwestern. You graduated. You know, obviously, sports has been a part of your life. But you went to work in consulting. And I'm curious if there was like an entrepreneurial spark in you, even in those days, or whether you kind of found entrepreneurship later on.
No, I definitely found entrepreneurship later on. I would say I was never really interested. It's not even that I wasn't even interested. It never even crossed my mind that was something I could do, sports or otherwise. It just was not something, you know, nobody I knew was an entrepreneur. None of my friends were pursuing any kind of entrepreneurial ventures. It was 2004 when I graduated college. So, you know, Facebook had started to take off, but it's not like the entrepreneurial culture that exists in colleges today. So it wasn't even just a thought that I had. I was recruited out of Northwestern to go to this consulting firm. And then I went to another consulting firm after that. And when I was in business school, I started a club called the Government and Business Association at NYU Stern. And at NYU, starting a club is a lot like starting a business. And that was originally, which is not like at a lot of business schools. A lot of business schools is a lot easier. But our club was the first club that NYU had started in 5 years. And it was right at, so I went to business school I started in September of 2008. So it was both a good and bad time, I guess, to be in business school because actually a lot of the people a year above me had job offers at Lehman Brothers. So I guess it goes to show you.
Right.
In September, they did. In October, they didn't.
Okay. Right.
So, yeah.
They might have stole the offers. Lehman just didn't exist.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right, exactly.
So you're at B school when, you know, during this tumultuous time. And you, I find this interesting. Like, you go to school and you walk out ready to start B6A. I mean, you did not take a job afterwards, which is like you've just invested all this money
right
you know, justifiably, I mean, you can invest that kind of money in yourself to be a better entrepreneur. But I'm curious of whether there was, like, you know, family pushback, like, you know, shouldn't you be getting a job to pay off this, you know, this investment type stuff?
I think there's still that family pushback to get a job to pay. But the short answer is, and again, I know this was disclosed in the introduction, is, you know, we did some consulting work in the meantime, and we did some consulting work for your company that helped us. So having that as a safety net allowed us to really pursue the business. And I would say, you know, while we started it and I had the idea for it in business school, we really didn't go at it full tilt until 2013. So I graduated in 2010, and we were spending a lot of time doing consulting work, and we had some, you know, it was more like consulting-based projects when we first started. So I would say the company now that exists really started in 2013. So that, but you're absolutely right. I mean, part of the reason that people, entrepreneurship still only consists of a very small percentage of graduates from business schools is the exact reason. People have student debts, they have, you know, loans that they have to pay off. Typically, you know, they have to, they want to, there are a lot of jobs in marketing and consulting and investment banking that are guaranteed to pay a lot more money right away versus when you're obviously starting a new company. You know, you're looking for a payoff potentially when you sell the company or you take the company public, but that should be a while. So the rewards can be greater, but the obviously the risk is much greater. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think I ever really had that pressure because we had the foundation with consulting, but it's something that I felt a lot. And, you know, it's still something that we, you know, I think about.
So, you know, I've been so far back now, I'm trying to piece it together myself, even though I've known you all these years. So, but for the first 3 years, so you're consulting at our firm, MBA Mission, and are you iterating on the idea or just sort of developing it? Like, there's sort of a bit of a pivot and then.
Yeah, so the original idea actually, so I guess I could probably start out with more background about the company. So, Block 6 Analytics is a sports sponsorship technology and analytics firm. So, what we have done is we've created a software as a service or a web based platform where buyers and sellers of sports sponsorship can go into the platform. They can see how much value they've gotten for a sponsorship, both sponsorships that they've already purchased and potentially that they will purchase in the future. And they can track the value of that sponsorship in near real time. So if I'm one of our clients is the Philadelphia 76ers. If I'm the Philadelphia 76ers, I have all this information that I can share to all of my different partners to say, this is the value that you got with working with us. Here are some new ideas for new sponsorship opportunities. Here's, you know, potentially you want to expand your relationship with us. Here's everything that we're doing, and here's the reason why we're doing it. And then if I'm a buyer of sports sponsorship, you know, Pepsi being one of our clients, if I'm a buyer of sports sponsorship, I want to get information in near real time so I can make asset allocation. So should I be spending money in television? Should I be spending money in venue, in events, online, in social media? And with Pepsi in particular, they were testing out new ideas and sponsorship based off a relationship they had with the Dallas Cowboys, which while we're recording this is soon to be our client. Hopefully by the time you're hearing this is our client. But the idea is that both sides of both the buyer and seller can see the advertising inventory. So the way I came up with that idea is while I was in business school, I interned for the Washington Capitals. So now we're in hockey territory. So Jeremy,
that's my comfortable space.
Exactly.
But the only one team. I really am. I don't follow the NHL. I follow one team.
That's right. Yeah. And we might get into that later.
Okay.
So the Washington Capitals. You know, I saw they had a need for a sponsorship platform. So originally the platform was just going to be a place where you could see the assets that were available or you could see what could be sponsored. From that, I came up with the idea of using business school training essentially to help create a new valuation model for sponsorship that is completely transparent. So you can see everything that we're doing and see why we get the values that we get. And then from that, it took a while to get the model exactly right. It's taken a long time to get the technology to where we're, and we're still iterating on the technology today. We've built in some new technology, which we can go into later, that leverages artificial intelligence, machine learning, neural networks, natural language processing, which was not even an idea that I would have had when I first started. And it took a while. And it's also the sports industry. What I like to say at the time is that the sports industry then is kind of where baseball was before Moneyball happened, right? Mm-hmm. There was an idea that numbers could be helpful, but it wasn't clear, and there wasn't like a structure for how numbers could be used to help the business side of sports, particularly sponsorship.
So maybe make that real for us. Like if, it, you know, I mean, you don't have to use an actual client, but like, you know, what was so out of whack or even appropriate? Like were you looking around saying like, oh, you know, you know, the ad, the digital ad during commercial breaks or during things that were supposed to be commercial breaks, sorry, you know, on the field during an NFL game, that sells for X, it should sell for X minus Y, or it should sell for X plus Y. I mean, is that basically...
Yeah, that's a big part of it. So we're not just a valuation company, we're a technology-based platform that uses analytics. So the valuation is a big piece of what we do, but literally just saying, like, what is in my sponsorship, right? And if you're the team, it's like, what actually is available to buy, right? Mm-hmm. Even today, it's sometimes hard to figure that out. So just literally like getting like what's available to buy. Also, like teams spend a lot of time creating manual reports that should be automated. So they were spending a lot of time developing PowerPoints that says this is what you got for your sponsorship. In the past, sponsorship was a very much a gut level decision. It was kind of, you know, if you know we're in New York now, if I went to Citi Field and City could see its logo on top of the stadium, it'd be like, oh, that's really cool. I can see City. There's got to be some value to that. I may not know exactly what it is, but I know there's some value to that. And the way that reporting was typically done, if you were trying to get X plus Y or X minus Y, is we see here's the picture of your sponsorship in action, if there was any reporting at all. And that's just like not, you know, if you're talking about any other advertising channel, that wouldn't fly, right? And it's still, and what's happened over time and where, you know, and I think this is an interesting point is, you know, when you're talking about market and product fit, I think we were a little bit ahead of where the market was and for the solution we wanted to have, where now the market has caught up and now everything is starting to be numbers based, quantitative based, data driven based. There's still a narrative element to sports. People love sports, right? And there's a lot of reasons people love sports. But using data is becoming much, much a bigger deal in that spot.
So are you saying that maybe this is an oversimplification, but are you saying that prior, you know, 10 years ago, or when I was a kid, 20 years ago, when Target sponsored the Target Center in Minneapolis, was one of the first, if I recall, to have a naming rights deal, or, you know, when you got the Buick Open or something like that for golf or something like that, that this was just kind of like, look, we're putting out the number here. If someone wants to take it, and like we can't really define how valuable it's going to be for you.
Yeah, I mean, if you're talking about like a good way to compare it is like now with even with Facebook, right? If you go on your own Facebook account and you want to see digital metrics, I mean, you can see impressions and video views. If you go like if you have your own web page and you want Google Analytics, like you can see a lot of information in Google Analytics. You can see unique visitors, you can see time on page, you can see click through rates. You can see, you know, you can just see a bunch of information by time. It's just with sports sponsorship, because it's not only digital based, it's these integrated packages. So there would be something like you'd have the sign at the Target Center, you'd have a commercial on television, you might have a radio ad, you might have, you know, a digital billboard on the website. So how would you even collect all that information, aggregate it in a way that makes sense, and then put a value calculation on it? And in the past, it's either that the team itself, the buyer has put a valuation on it and or the seller has put a valuation on it. And again, there wasn't necessarily this need to get like a data-driven decision.
Right.
As data has become more and more important in other advertising channels, and you know, we were talking about this before and this has been publicly reported, you know, companies like Pepsi and Coca-Cola, you know, they spend hundreds of millions of dollars on sponsorship.
Right.
So the idea of not getting that level of sophistication is just not going to fly. I mean, people, you know, you're talking about shareholders or you're talking about the media, or you're talking about employees.
Right.
Like, they're asking for this type of information. They just weren't asking for it in the past. And maybe, you know, people didn't necessarily need it as much in the past, where that's changed a lot. It's not just changed in sponsorships. It's changed in all types of advertising.
Right.
So actually, it's a good example. So, like, the CMO of Procter & Gamble literally said a few weeks ago, all advertising is crap because we don't know how to value it. So it's not just in sports, right? There is a lot more information, but it's still like, how do you value it? The issue is that there is, and we think this is an issue potentially in the larger advertising space, there is a lack of transparency when it comes to valuation, because if you have to show somebody how you got value, then they can poke holes in your valuation, or they can say like, oh, we don't agree with how you did this. But what both buyers and sellers need is a language of sports sponsorship. Like, how can you have a conversation around value if nobody's speaking the same language? So what we want to do, because we're a technology company, we want to use our analytics and our data to create a language around advertising. So when you get a number, you know exactly what that number means. If you know exactly what that number means, everybody makes more money, right? The buyer can say, this is where I should spend my money. The seller can say, this is why you should spend your money here. And that seems to be better for everybody.
Right. And you can adjust that according to people's, like, objectives, right?
So yeah, exactly.
And if I'm Jeremy's Concretes and I want clients out of this, that's different than, hey, I'm Pepsi and I want to, generally speaking, build my brand. I'm not expecting people to go to the store and buy Pepsi.
Well, maybe, maybe yes, maybe no, but right, exactly. Different brands, like Pepsi is a good example. Like, do you need to build brand awareness around the Pepsi brand, or do people generally know the Pepsi brand? Versus, like, what you're talking about even is more brand perception. Do you want them to have better feelings and associations? And I think that's very much an important part of what Pepsi is doing. And that's from no inside information. I think you can see from the activations that they've done that brand perception is definitely very important, where that's another thing that's been missing in sponsorship. What I think has been missing in sponsorship valuation is creating specific valuations for specific companies for specific opportunities, right? Pepsi should get a different value than an Oracle, right? They're completely different businesses. Pepsi is a B2C or right. wants retail customers. Oracle wants enterprise customers. Why should they have the same value? Yet typically they have been given the same value. So it just doesn't make sense. From our perspective. So we've made adjustments based off those factors.
So let's talk about you personally here, because yeah. you are one of the grittiest entrepreneurs I know. So I want to hear, I was joking around about the fact that you have a beard because it limits your spend on razors.
Exactly.
Tell us about some of the sacrifices.
Well, I will say I probably have a beard because my girlfriend recommended that I should have a beard. And I jokingly say maybe she wanted to see less of my face, particularly with the wear and tear.
If she didn't say it or you didn't say it, I was going to say
exactly,
it.
Exactly, right?
So, yeah.
I think you're right. There is a level of grittiness. I'm not sure the grittiest, you've had a lot of entrepreneurs in here. They've all worked really hard. I mean, the definition of entrepreneur.
I mean, maybe it's just because I saw it personally.
Yeah,
I mean, I saw how hard. I mean, you were working at MBA Mission, a full-time job.
Yeah.
And nothing was being left behind at Block 6 Analytics. You were just working two full-time jobs to keep yourself going. And if I recall, a lot of working at MBA Mission was actually just to fund Block 6 Analytics, keep that going.
And that's something I think we'll talk about a little bit later is the funding process for a company. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, we were using the money, both personally and, for me to survive personally, but also to help fund the company and fund the company's growth. And as we were iterating and developing the technology, we would use the money from MBA Mission in order to help fund the business. And you're right. I mean, that is not atypical from an entrepreneurial perspective, is that you have to do, especially if you're not going to raise capital, or either you don't have the opportunity or you choose not to raise capital and you're not personally wealthy, you have to be able to fund the money and you need capital as the blood of the business. So you're going to have to work hard. You're going to have to work a lot. And that's just the necessity of the idea. And, one of the reasons I kept working on what, besides I have a passion for sports, is I did think that the industry was going to eventually come and meet with the idea. The technology would get where it needs to go. The industry was going to look for this information. We got enough traction early on to say, people are interested in what we're doing. And we just need to be able to build this at scale and get more people involved. And that's what we've been doing, particularly over the past 12 months. It just takes a lot of work. I mean, you have to work really hard. And there's a romantic idea of entrepreneurship, whether you're thinking about, the Mark Zuckerbergs or even the Steve Cases or whatever the idea is, that you'll have this great idea. And, if you have a great idea, you can turn it into a great business. And whether or not you think my company has a great idea or not, it's just not easy to turn an idea into a business. And that's something you learn every day as an entrepreneur.
I have I think I counted 31 questions here, and we're at question 4. So
maybe do a little rapid fire.
We'll bring you back for a triple play episode. We actually did it for one individual once, came back. I was also always really impressed by the fact that you never really doubted that you were going to succeed, at least from an external perspective. You were very, very certain that this was going to work. I mean, were there moments where you were ever considered throwing in the towel? I mean, beyond the regular moments, I consider throwing the towel every once in a while.
I think there were a lot of those regular moments, and I think there definitely are. You're always kind of, we were talking about this a little bit earlier, but when you're talking about entrepreneurship, there's, it's a little bit of, and for lack of a better term, is a little mania, right? There's really big highs, there's really big lows. It's rarely that you're necessarily comfortably going. I mean, that's the point. Right. One of the points of entrepreneurship is that you're at these highs and lows.
Right.
So there are definitely a lot of highs, especially when you're starting out, and I hate using cliches, although I'm going to use one now, is it's a lot of, one step forward, two step backwards when you're getting started. And you want to get to the point where it's two steps forward, one step backward, and then obviously just going forward. But when you're going backwards and you're iterating on new technology or something doesn't work or a deal falls through, you know, you do question it. And, you know, when you're looking at your bank balance and the cash flow is getting lower than you would like, and, you know you have demands for your cash flow on going forward, and you got to figure out where the next dollar is coming from. Absolutely. You know, you have to, a sane person would have to doubt whether that makes sense. But I think the confidence was, you know, like, I knew the industry well. I was in process of writing a book about it. I was in, you know, I was talking to a lot of people. It was clear that there was interest in what we were doing, at least from a certain number of people, particularly some early adopters. And, you know, it, by having some demonstrable proof that this idea was good, or that the idea would resonate with our clients, enabled me to keep going.
So what is that? I mean, tell us about that process of making that first sale, like going into someone's office, who is a decision maker, you know, high up in the sports world, I'm assuming, and maybe not.
Tell us
the story. Why am I painting a picture that may not have existed? How does a guy walk in with an idea and get that first corporate sale?
Well, there's a few different ways. And essentially, and I think we'll go through this, or you went through this in the introduction, but, you know, I teach a class called Entrepreneurship in Sports at Northwestern in the Masters of Sports Administration program. And one of the things that we talk about, we focus on, is you have to reduce the risk, right? There was this old saying, which doesn't really apply now, like, nobody got fired for hiring IBM, right? There's a safe choice that you can do. So you have to show, in particular, and this is something I've personally just gotten better with over time, and I still think I have some ways to go, but you have to be able to communicate why this is important and valuable to this person. In particular, how are you going to make this person look good by taking on your product or service offering?
Right.
And if you can say, like, yes, you could go with whatever the equivalent of is IBM, but here is how you are going to be, here's how you are going to benefit, and or here's what you are going to lose if you don't sign up with our service offering. That is something that you can clear. If you can clearly communicate that customer proposition, it reduces the risk because you can show them and you can make it very clear how something is going to be better. So with the University of Hartford, which was our first client, again, not, you know, I love University, obviously they were our first client. They do some really interesting work. It's Division I, especially in basketball and baseball, and Division I college program. But obviously it's not like the biggest program in the world. But they were specifically, because it's University of Hartford, in their backyard is the University of Connecticut, right? And they specifically had a competitive dynamic where they had to differentiate themselves from the University of Connecticut. So they wanted to use the system to say, you know, a little bit of what's called judo strategy, right? Use the strength of the University of Connecticut against itself. So the University of Connecticut is large. So if you want a customizable individual sponsorship that directly fits your needs, you should go to the University of Hartford. And using our approach in order to communicate that value would generate incremental revenue growth that they wouldn't have gotten before. And because I was able to articulate it enough, what the vision of the company was and how it could work, that's how we were able to sign them on as a client. And, you know, the hardest client is always the first client. And once you're able to get one client, then we were able to move on to other clients. We started with the Minnesota Timberwolves. Then we ended up moving into the Minnesota United. So somebody from the Minnesota Timberwolves went to the Minnesota United, which is going to be the newest MLS team starting soon. Or it might have already started by the time you heard this.
You're going to leave to play goal for them, or are you going to stick with the...
Well, it depends on if
they want...
Can't
show me a record. You can't,
yeah,
you
know, I know. It depends on if they want to lose or not. Yeah. But that's their strategy, I guess. but yeah, and then from that, we built out, you know, then we've added in the 76ers and the Browns. And to be clear, I just want to be very clear. People ask us, we don't only work with teams that have struggled on the court or on the field. You know, we talked about it again by this time. Hopefully we're working with the Dallas Cowboys, and we work with teams in the NBA and NHL, in addition to Pepsi and Gatorade. And, you know, those kind of build on each other as we go forward.
With so many teams out there, there's so many professional sports teams. It's not just the big four leagues, which
right.
is arguably the big three leagues, but there are, I'm ripping hockey there.
I was going to say, like, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, you're talking about, like, you know, there's minor league teams,
sure.
in every sport, and, I mean, we don't realize how it's college teams, and they're so vast. How do you know where to use a little Buffett parlance, point the elephant gun, so to speak? Like, how do you start to attack this market?
Yeah, what's nice about the sports industry as compared to potentially other industries, it is very network intensive, and people definitely talk to each other. They go to job to job. And if you're able to break in, it is very difficult to break into the sports industry. But if you are able to break in, there's a lot of referrals that can happen. And the 76ers have provided us with a lot of referrals. Like I said, the Timberwolves provided us with referrals. As you start to gain a little bit of traction, people want to see new ideas and new new ways of doing things. So, you know, we've recorded a case study that we'll be publishing soon with Pepsi. So the idea of Pepsi getting value will enable us to help grow, particularly on the, not on the team side, but on the brand side of our business. So in sports, luckily, it is a very referral-based business, but also you have to understand where the revenue is coming from. So while there are a lot of different sports teams, there are also, like, you know, there's a, you can say the Fortune 1000 companies, right? Are there really 1,000 sports organizations that are going to use our system? We hope so, but that's, getting to 1,000 is a lot more difficult. Where are there, you know, in the Fortune 1000, there's obviously, that's just 1,000 companies right there, a lot of them who spend a lot of money in sports. So, you know, looking at the company side, looking at the agency side, looking at where you can generate revenue at scale. And that's really what, you know, a VC-backed company needs to do. It needs to be able to generate revenue at scale. And that's what we're really focused on. So finding those opportunities that allow us to do that is helpful.
So I don't know where to go. We're way off script. Doesn't matter. But what's also, so I mean, another thing that's interesting is that, like, companies evolve. At the beginning, it's just you, and you
right.
are scrappy and gritty. And I mean, to give one example, I mean, I guess this is more recent, but like, I just called you one day and was like, hey, I think I'm going to meet the, just inadvertently, I'm going to meet, you know, I'm not hanging in these circles. I'm going to meet the owner of the Islanders.
Right.
I want to be in New York, like, in 12 hours, and you were there.
Right.
Which of course, you know, one does, and suddenly it's a cheap flight, but still, like, you know, you're ready to go. But, you know, so it's different from, like, between, you know, being yourself and getting stuff done, and then like switching
yes.
to a position where you're managing other people.
Right.
And, you know, that's a tough transition for a lot of people, me included. And,
yeah.
you know, I mean, what was that transition like? Like, what kind of manager are you? You know, because you're such an intense guy in your own
yeah.
work. You know, are you a hands-off manager? Are you hands-on,
so
et cetera?
Long question, sorry. No, it's a really good question. I mean, this is something we talk about in the class, right? As you go from you know, yourself, and as you continue to grow, it's a completely different skill set, right? Managing people is different than creating and monetizing a product and a service offering. And being able to successfully manage people requires a different skill set. And what I try to do, and you can, I guess, ask my employees off the record if I do this successfully, but the idea is that what we try to focus is what's good for anyone is what's good for everyone, right? You want to incentivize employees to do and have the activities that make it so when they individually are successful, the company as a whole is successful. And for me and for us, it really is, what I want to do is I want to hire really smart people, and we've thankfully done that, really smart, really capable people. And being in sports helps because a lot of people like being in sports, but a lot of our employees have no interest in sports, and they're just interested in the challenge. And we can go through that because it's a really funny, there's a couple really funny stories there. But the idea is that if you tell, like, I want to say, like, this is what I want to have done. Like, I want, you know, we have a new idea potentially for a new product, or we have a new idea for how we want to get a new client on board, or we have a new idea, or we have our current products and our current systems. And I would say, this is what I want them to do. Now you go figure out how you want to do it. So what we try to do is have meetings, but limit the number of meetings. So we want to give people the time to really think about and have a creative process. And one of the things that you and I have talked about a lot, I think, is, you know, having ownership, right? If they do, all employees obviously have equity, but having ownership in the product themselves. So we've had employees when we've fortunately been in the press a lot, or relatively speaking a lot for a company of our size. And, you know, when employees see us in the press, they're happy to show it. They're ecstatic to show it to their parents and to their
right.
loved ones. And it's because they feel bought in. And I think it's because, you know, I am very intense as a person, especially when it comes to this stuff. And you're very intense about, you know, your company. It's your company. It's, I hate saying your baby because obviously you actually have babies and I don't. But like, it's like, you know, you put a lot, you know, you put a lot of time and energy and effort into this. And, you know, these employees have come on board, particularly for us, a lot have come on board recently. And to get them bought in quickly is something that you want to do. So fortunately for us, we have employees who had experience in, you know, some of them who had experience in space and clearly understood what we were trying to do, and they were bought into the mission early. And some of the employees were just like, this is a really interesting challenge, and you're giving me the opportunity at a relatively young age to go address this challenge. So finding people where they have ownership and have really meaningful impact on the business and allowing them to do that is important while still managing them and making sure the company's moving forward.
So you are an intense guy, but you're also you're also a chill guy in a weird way.
Yeah,
and
I try to be.
So, I mean, you know, your intensity is sort of like quiet and internal. What ruffles your feathers in terms of running your managing your teams?
Well, you know, I think what ruffles the feathers is, there's a few things. One is, like, you try to be as hands-off as possible, but when things go wrong, you know, you want to dive in and fix it as quickly as possible. And I, you know, you were talking about before being a solo founder. For some companies, they do not have solo founders. Some companies, it's better to have co-founders, particularly ones that have technical experience, where I don't have core technical experience, where I built out the analytical models. We now have a CTO who's implementing the technology and knows is building out the code and the structure for that. And if something goes wrong with the technology, it's not like I can go in there and fix it and do the coding. And that's something that we have to rely on other people to do. And as much as I like to say, like, yes, I want them to go and do it, when something goes wrong, it's really hard to sit there and let the other, let other people do their jobs. Mm-hmm. And that's something I'm still getting better at. And on the flip side, I've said we've gotten a lot more market adaption fit, but like, it's still hard when somebody says, like, we're interested in doing this, but we don't necessarily want to move forward, because, again, you still feel like they're not necessarily rejecting the company, they're rejecting you as a person, right? Mm-hmm. Because even as we continue to grow, and hopefully we'll grow out to be, a huge company, $1 billion company, but it's still, at the end of the day, this is my idea and something that I thought of, and we've got a lot of great people helping to build on my vision, but it still kind of is disappointing if they reject the product, even though, because it still kind of feels like they're rejecting you a little bit. So I would say those are the two big things that come up. And then, the third big thing, and this is pretty much for all companies, is that as we continue to grow and take on venture money, you have to deal with more investors. And investors, rightfully so, want to have input and want to be able to help you grow the business. And they're not times you're always going to see eye to eye, and that's natural in these types of situations. So that's a new challenge that we've been dealing with more frequently now.
So okay, so that's a good segue. Yeah. So you raise some money from investors, sort of a hybrid like seed Series A round.
Yeah.
There was friends and family in it, including this friend, and and then. But the family part is interesting, right? So I think your uncle's in it. Your parents are in the friends.
My uncle was in it, so he's not in it now. But he was. But my parents are definitely involved.
How frequently do your parents bring it up? Are they like
only all the time?
Only all the time. Only all the time.
The biggest theme now is that they want to use the money to retire to Florida. So again, going back to Jewish stereotypes, right? So
I figure there's one of two answers on that one: either never or all the time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it's definitely a polar, one or the other. Yeah.
So they're in all the time.
And to be fair, they don't like not in an intense way, but it's kind of in a jokey way. But it's definitely
but
like
they want to know.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
They want the shareholder report as much as possible.
Okay. What is the publicly reported as $1.8 million? What does that allow you to do? What's the difference between before and after that?
Yeah, I mean, what it really does allow you to do, unfortunately, when I went to business school, they really hammered home the issues that come up with raising money. There's a lot of, besides the fact that you get dilution, you have to have people involved. It takes a long time to do it. If you can fund from operational capital or bootstrap it as much as you can, it's often recommended to do that, where I think we waited a little too long to really try to raise money. And part of it was at a point where we were trying to raise money, it wasn't always as easy as just like, oh, I want to go raise money now, let's go raise money. It takes a long time. And that was a big part of my day-to-day as we were growing as a business, was closing out this finance round. What this money does allow us to do is allow us to look at what we like to look at is, business process and technology. Business technology and people. So from a business side, we can be much more aggressive in going out and targeting clients. And we really are focused on acquiring as many clients as possible right now to move from a, a seed stage company really to and we're really in a growth phase right now and continue and facilitate our growth, because we can go and we have the confidence that, if we need to invest more resources in what we need to do, we can do that. And then from a technology perspective in particular, we're able to grow out our technology resources and start to create and service new products at scale. So in particular, machine learning, we have what's called our media analysis platform, which is really focused on how do you identify television viewable objects and signs. So, if you're watching a game, if you're a sports fan at all, you've probably seen, signs, particularly at NBA games, signs on television. So we have a system that can automatically tell you the value, how close it was to the center of the screen, how basically give a clarity score, how clear was it on the screen, how much of the screen it took up, and the time on screen. And we can get the results back and into our system within 48 hours. And that's something having the money allows us to build a more robust technology platform where we can do that at speed and at scale. And the last thing it helps to do, and again, this is not atypical for any organization, allows us to hire more people. So we have a significant, knock on wood, we have a significant demand for our service offering right now, and we have to be able to scale up our people. And we're not necessarily, because we're a technology and a scalable technology company, we don't want to add on a ton of people, but we do need to add on more people to make sure we can service the demand that we have and continue to grow as a business. So the money allows us to hire more people and be more competitive in the marketplace for human capital.
So if you could go back, this is a ludicrous question, but if you could go back and just, because you have some, they won't be named, but you have some legitimate venture investors in your round.
I don't know what illegitimate investors would be, but yes.
I guess it's, compared to illegitimate ones like me and your parents, would you get us out of the round? Would you sleep better at night without your friends and family, you know, in this? Or is it just like, hey, they're...
I mean, I think it's actually a really good question. I'm surprised nobody's really ever asked me that before.
And yeah, I do my homework.
Yeah, flattery gets you everywhere. That's what I tell people, so... So sucking up to an investor can't hurt, right? No, I actually don't think so, because I think all the investors had the right perspective, right? All of the friends and family have been helpful, you know, not just on a financial level, but on a business level in terms of making introductions, but also just on a human level, right? They're all invested in me, and they would, like, my parents would be invested in me anyway, even if they weren't invested as human beings. Like, you're a friend, right? You're invested in me. You've seen what we're doing. And it's not like they're, you know, we're not saying I was joking about my parents' retirement, but they're certainly not betting their retirement on my company being successful. So if everybody, you know, if you're very upfront with your friends and family saying, you know the risk, and we were talking about this before, but it's something like 25% of venture-backed companies are successful, right? That means 75% of them fail.
Right.
So like, if you're saying like, and the same with the stock market, right? If you know going in that the stock market, like over time, the stock market accretes in value, and the entirety of the stock market accretes in value and has for a certain amount, like, you know, decades, essentially.
Yeah.
If you know what the risks are going in, it'd be great to have them as investors. But what the institutional capital allows you to do, one is that, you know, we're talking about risk profile, having institutional capital and having really, you know, like you're saying, legitimate, so to speak, investors allows you to, it puts you in a different space, and it enables you to talk to people in a different way, and you're just perceived in a different way,
right,
not just by other investors, but by other clients, and it makes it much more easier to raise money in the future. So I think for us, we actually got the best of all worlds, right? We were able to get people who really bought in and believed in us at first, but also getting really, you know, like you said, really great people to back us who are really, you know, invested in our company's growth and can be with us for a long period of time whatever period of time it is, to help us grow as a company.
How much better, like, considering that trajectory of, you know, hey, I've got this kind of, it was like a slow boil through that round, right?
It's interesting, right? It was a slow boil until it wasn't, right? As soon as there was, you know, I think there was demand, and I think we were getting, and me personally was getting better at pitching the business to investors.
That was
investors.
The question, yeah. How much better do you get? Like, what's the curve like that? You know, how many slam doors? And then you're like...
Yeah. I mean, I think it's also like the business was... It always helps when the business is more successful and we were getting more clients on board. But I think it's also, you do get, I mean, whether you're doing sales, like, I didn't have a sales background before I started the company, right? And I became, you were saying before, like the lead salesperson, or that I was for a long time the chief revenue officer of the company. So I had to learn how to sell, not just sell the business, but sell me personally. And that's not something I was necessarily used to doing. Now it is, as my girlfriend would say, not a problem. But at the time it was, like, just not something I was used to doing. And I had to get better at it. And same with investment, right? You know, investors are interested in your idea. They're interested in your business. They're interested in your future vision. But ultimately, a lot of the investors are investing in people, right? They think this is the team that can execute this idea. And this is the person in particular who's going to lead that team executing on that idea. And being able to clearly articulate your vision is absolutely critical to them believing in you as a person and believing you in you as a company. And until you get that right, which, again, it takes a lot of time to get that right, and you shouldn't expect yourself to get it right at the beginning, and there will be some learnings. But once you get it right, you know, you can really go in and feel confident that you put your best effort forward. And I think it's just right. It was an alignment for us of getting the messaging right, having the business grow, and finding the right investors. So there's also different, we were spending a lot of time, because the company is based in Chicago, and I currently live in Chicago, and we have a Chicago and New York office, but there's a completely different investment environment in Chicago than there is even,
not even
in Palo Alto or California or San Francisco, but the investment and the risk profile of investors in New York is just completely different than it is in Chicago.
You're on your way to Boston for the Sloan Sports Analytics Conference, the MIT Sloan Sports Analytics Conference.
Nerdapalooza, as it's called in the sports industry.
Okay, you were kinder than I was.
Yeah.
I was going to say kind of the Woodstock of sports analytics. Your book actually was given out
a couple of years ago.
One of the, that's, I guess that's the difference in the Academy Awards, where you get, like, I don't know, for a shawl or something like that.
Well,
they get a book from Adam Grossman.
Yeah, the MIT Sloan, right, you get a book from me. It was funny, actually. So there's an Adam Grossman, who is, I think, is now still the chief marketing officer of the Boston Red Sox.
Oh, really?
So both of us were there, and people went up to him and asked him to sign the book, and people went up to me asking for comments on the Red Sox. So we were jokingly saying we should each comment on either of the other ones.
But, just walk around holding hands.
Yeah, exactly, right? Yeah. But yeah, I mean, at the Oscars, you get a $100,000 gift bag, where at the MIT Sloan Conference, you get my book. So I think it's a fair trade. I think it's totally even.
So even this year, they still get your book?
No, it was just in 2015, but okay. I am speaking at the conference. But
what are you speaking on?
On machine learning.
And
then how Pepsi used our machine learning platform to value in near real time, value their relationship with the Cowboys. And that's one of the unique things about my company. We can work with both sides of a transaction. So like I said, we worked with Pepsi.
Right, they both value the
information. And working with the Cowboys, which is something that it's hard to think of another company that would be able to do it.
So let's go over some of the, now that you're coming sort of full circle here, valuing the advertisements. I mean, are there things that you found where you're just like, wow, like people were really valuing that in the wrong way?
No comment, I guess. But
broadly speaking,
No, it's not even a special sauce. It's just, you know, I think it, generally speaking, I think, like, there's a difference between, like I said before, there's a difference between business to consumer and business to business companies. And I don't think necessarily, like, and this is just generally, not necessarily with any of our clients, right? Does it make sense for a company like Oracle to advertise during the Super Bowl when, while there are 113 million people watching the Super Bowl, does it make sense for them? Because there aren't 113 million enterprise clients who are going to probably make a decision if to use Oracle or not, right?
Right.
It just doesn't make sense.
So just breaking that into plain English, what you're saying is
they're
being charged on like a per viewer basis.
So yeah,
millions and millions of viewers have no value.
So the standard standard advertising metric is called CPM, which means cost per thousand impressions, right? So the way that advertising still is a lot of times valued now is, you know, when people talk about ratings and you're saying, well, the Oscars got, what, I think it was like 33 million people, the Grammys got 26 million people, the Super Bowl gets 113 million people. People are obsessed with ratings in television because you're getting charged usually on a CPM. Essentially, how many people are watching it? The more people who are watching it, the better it is for a company because you get more people who are seeing your brand either during commercials or during television viewable signage. Now for Oracle, if the vast majority of those people are never gonna make a purchasing decision, how valuable is it really to them, right? Who cares if, like, unfortunately, for you not me, because I guess we're a technology company, but like for most people, right, if 112 million, let's say conservatively, if the 113 million are never going to purchase Oracle, right, why would they do that, right? Even if on a CPM basis, it might be great, but on a actual value to their business, it doesn't make any sense. So, and there's also like one of the things that, and again,
shouldn't that be obvious to Oracle beyond just like, you know, like not to devalue,
well,
especially
Oracle,
investor, but like, shouldn't they be able to say that on their own? Be like, I don't need a sports analytics guy to tell me, like, wow, this is just a waste of money.
Well, I would say, like, again, Oracle, it wasn't necessarily going through this process.
Right.
Obviously,
no,
it's an example. But, like, no, I mean, I think that's the top line examples. And there's much more detailed examples. And you were talking about before with, you know, large companies. Do large companies need increases in brand awareness? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. But you want to know the specific situations in which they do need increases in brand awareness. And particularly when it comes to television viewable signage, like, different companies will get different values. There are definitely companies, you know, one of the great, or arguably great television ads was GoDaddy during the Super Bowl. So GoDaddy basically did a bet the company ad,
right,
which is like in the Super Bowl where they used Danica Patrick to advertise GoDaddy because nobody knew who GoDaddy was. And like everybody knew who GoDaddy was after the commercial. So that commercial makes a lot of sense.
Right.
Versus like, right, I mean, if you're talking about a Super Bowl ad for this year's Super Bowl, it's $5 million just to buy the time for the ad. That's not even creating the ad,
right,
not all the, you know, whether you're gonna build a social media campaign, hire actors, film it, whatever it is. So it really doesn't make sense for your business. It's just something you have to think about. Again, there's no right or wrong answer. It's just like really in-depth looking at what you're trying to accomplish. And like another good example is like Bud Light, right? Bud Light has a very extensive deal with the NFL and Budweiser as a company, which makes a lot of sense when they are able to use the Budweiser slogan is beer with your team on it, right? When they put the logos of NFL teams on their cans, they get something like a 25% lift in sales. Mm-hmm. So it's like I'm not sure that's obvious that would happen, but that is something that does happen,
right,
and that is a really valuable sponsorship. So again, it's those types of things where you can create insights to do that.
Are you able to watch a game and enjoy it, or can you shut it down? Seriously, I mean, I know it sounds ridiculous, but can you turn it off?
It was actually one of my biggest worries about starting this business is like, I love sports. Do I want to? And something we were having a little debate about, you know, Baseball Hall of Fame earlier. And it's like, if I knew all the and fantasy football, like I love fantasy football. Could I do fantasy football without building out some model that would say like, this is who I should draft? And like, if I didn't do that, would I really feel bad about it? So yes, the short answer is yes, I am able to turn off that part of my brain. I still, so I'm from the Washington DC area. So from a pure fandom perspective, I'm a Washington fan, but I did go, so the Dallas Cowboys are a, Dallas Cowboys and Washington Redskins are big rivals, and I told Dallas, the Dallas Cowboys, that I would immediately sell out my fandom if they were to sign on as a client. So I'm definitely a complete sellout on that front.
Well, as you know, I guess we have time for one last question here. As you know, where my allegiances lie when it comes to sports, the Winnipeg Jets. I think I'm one of the few rabid fans outside of the Winnipeg metropolitan area. Are we going to win the Cup, in, statistically speaking, win the Cup in 2018 or 2019?
So my investor response is you'll win it in both years. So get ready. It's coming. The Stanley Cup's coming to Winnipeg. But the longer answer is it's, you know, actually this goes to a kind of a larger point that I've made before in an article. But like competitive balance in sports, is there a lot of competitive balance? Now the leagues do a great job or attempt to do a great job to try to create competitive balance. You know, when we talk about competitive balance, it's like, you know, having the draft where the worst team gets the first pick and having a salary cap. So, and having, you know, revenue distributed among teams. Those are all things that leagues take in order to have competitive balance. The outcome hasn't always gotten to competitive balance. Like in the NHL, there have been certain teams that have, you know, more recently the Chicago Blackhawks, LA Kings, and even the Penguins. You know, those three teams have dominated Stanley Cups. And, you know, and this year it looks like, knock on wood, the Washington Capitals are the favorite to win the Stanley Cup, particularly after their recent trade for a defenseman whose name I can't pronounce. But
Shattenkirk.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so, yeah. And the Capitals, but the Capitals have consistently made the playoffs year in, year out. So teams across all leagues have been consistently performing. So, unfortunately, I think it is probably unlikely for your Jets to necessarily crack into in the 18 and 19, but maybe in the future. Though.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking
and when
wrong.
They do, we'll go to Winnipeg and we'll have a good time.
I think you're wrong because we have some incredible. Patrick Laine, and everyone can just log off now. The rest of this car,
yeah, I was going to say,
stop listening.
We heard the sound of all these podcasts stopping right now.
Nikolai Ehlers, Patrick Laine, and, you know, I mean, Patrick Laine, rookie, 30 goals this year. Nikolai Ehlers, I don't know how many goals he has. Just a phenomenal talent. The best Danish player to ever play in the NHL.
Yeah, but what,
only one season in.
What's their Corsi stat and what's their Fenwick stat, right?
I don't have any of that. I don't have any other Danes that have been in the NHL ever, actually, but I know he's the best. Yeah. You're going to hear from this team. You'll hear from Adam Grossman, too. Adam, my good friend, thank you for joining us. Good luck at the Sports Analytics Conference.
It's great to be here. This is it's always good for us
fun.
To get on the microphone.
Yeah, I hope that some of our other good friends listen to this, and you know, maybe you'll make it class required listening as well. You know,
well,
because Adam, did we mention Adam's a professor?
Yeah, I talked about it earlier, but of course, it's required listening. So, if nothing else, yeah, you got to make your students. What's the point of being a professor if you can't make them listen and read and watch all the stuff you're doing?
Exactly. All right, thanks so much for listening, everyone. Signing off.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.